Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Newcastle County Council features two new faces this year in Dave Carter and Dee Durham, and they're interested in putting environmental issues on the agenda.
Both Carter and Durham are quick to point out that it's not the council members opposed protecting and preserving the environment. Rather, it's that those sorts of issues haven't necessarily been a priority for them.
Contributor Larry Nagengast joins us with more on Carter and Durham. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also chat with the new head of eBright Health, the partnership between first aid hospitals that works on access to health care, as well as quality and affordability. Arts Playlist heads back to Lewis to check in with the sculptor behind Fearless Girl. And Enlighten Me examines what was lost when a historic Lenape church was destroyed by fire last month. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, Delaware's General Assembly opened a new session with 17 new members being sworn in. It's the largest class of new lawmakers in three decades. But it's not the only legislative body seeing notable change following the 2018 election cycle. The 13-person Newcastle County Council welcomed two new members in November, and while that may not seem like much, the impact could be significant. Dave Carter and Dee Durham both dispatched longtime incumbents, with Carter defeating three-term Councilman William Powers in a September Democratic primary, and Durham ousting 22-year Councilman Robert Weiner in November. And in addition to adding new voices to the debate, both come to council with an environmental activist background. Contributor Larry Nagengast caught up with Carter and Durham recently to delve deeper into what they bring to Newcastle County Council and where they stand on some key issues. What he learned is in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to talk more about it. So let's start with a little thumbnail sketch of who these two new council members are. Let's start with Dave Carter. What can you tell us about him?
Okay. Well, I mean, Carter's he's a real blue-collar sort of guy. He grew up in Newcastle, and he now represents a district that's in the southwestern part of the county. It's mostly below the C&D Canal. It includes Middletown and Townsend, but the way the line's drawn doesn't include Odessa. So he's got the M and T, but not the O. Lives on a farm in Townsend. His father was a factory worker. He trapped muskrats in the marshes when he was a boy to earn money to buy Christmas gifts. He went to William Penn High School in the early days of desegregation, and he made friends with many low-income kids who lived in some of those struggling neighborhoods that are closer to Wilmington than downtown Newcastle. And in those days, he saw a lot of environmental problems firsthand: flooding, deteriorating wetlands, air pollution, explosions at chemical plants. From there, he majored in bio at UD and then went on to a 28-year career as a manager in the State Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. After leaving state government, he earned master's and doctoral degrees at UD, and then he took on leadership roles in organizations like the Delaware Audubon Society.
And how about Dee Durham?
Dee comes from a slightly different background. She grew up in Brandywine 100, right on the edge of Brandywine Creek State Park. Nature and environmental activities were a big part of her childhood. She spent a lot of time riding horses and exploring the park. Her parents were civic-minded Quakers who were dedicated to community service, and their nonprofit work rubbed off on her extensively. Durham spent about 10 years as head of Preservation Delaware, a group dedicated to rescuing historic structures, most notably the Gibraltar Mansion in Wilmington. And then she went on to work for a nonprofit in Pennsylvania whose top priority was fighting a proposed widening of Route 41 from the Delaware state line up nearly to Lancaster. More recently, she founded a nonprofit that's called Plastic Free Delaware, whose goal is to reduce the use of single-use plastics like styrofoam and straws that pollute the environment and threaten wildlife. And for her efforts with this group, she received a governor's award for volunteer service last fall.
So why do these two feel motivated to run for public office and take on longtime county council members?
Three reasons. First, as you can gather from the descriptions I just gave, both Carter and Durham are highly motivated toward community service. Second, both of them believe that the county council's membership did not include strong advocates for conservation and environmental protection. And third, both of them live in districts where they believe that the prior council members representing those areas had become more responsive to special interests than to their constituents. So in a nutshell, that's the reason why both of them ran.
We often see people heavily involved in civic groups or activists eventually make their way into public office. But Carter and Durham, a bit different, based on what you were telling us, in that they come from this more environmental background. How unusual is that for Newcastle County Council, and is it a priority for both of them as they join council?
Dave Carter says that the council really hasn't had a member who's got a strong background in environmental issues since the early 2000s, when Karen Vineski was the council representative for the Newark area. And actually, that goes back more than a dozen years, because she served when the council still had only six members, six districts, and now there are 12 districts plus the council president. Now, both Carter and Durham are quick to point out that it's not that council members oppose protecting and preserving the environment. Rather, it's that those sorts of issues haven't necessarily been a priority for them. So let's just say that these two new council members hope that they're going to have a role in adjusting and shifting the council's overall focus.
Do they each have signature issues that they may pursue on council, or perhaps a shared goal or issue that they may find common ground on?
Well, it's fair to say there are a lot of overlaps here, and you can also count on Carter and Durham to be working together quite often. As far as identifying signature issues, well, let's start with Carter. I mean, you know, given his environmental and regulatory background with DENREC and his district being in the southern part of the county, land use, especially its impact on pollution and on farmland preservation, will be his major theme. He's also interested in strengthening monitoring of septic systems in areas not served by county sewers. And he says that's an issue throughout the county, not just below the canal. For Durham, the signature issue is likely to be historic preservation, preventing the demolition of historic properties, protecting historic sites from development. Historic preservation issues also tend to be land use issues, and she has plenty of concerns about redevelopment projects along Concord Pike, the main street in her district. Her predecessor, Bob Weiner, did a very good job of keeping his constituents informed of land use issues in the district. Durham not only hopes to match him in this regard, but she also gives every indication of being more questioning of the motivations of developers and the explanations that they give than Weiner was during the latter years of his tenure.
So let's dig in a little bit more on what you were just talking about, which is land use. It's certainly an issue that the county council regularly deals with. Talk a little bit more about, you know, their respective approaches, Carter and Durham, on this issue.
Both of them think that the county's land use department has strong leadership and a good, solid professional staff, but they also see a need for some fine-tuning and for some prioritizing. Now, we haven't seen any specific proposals yet from either one of them, but Carter thinks that the county should consider redefining what constitutes heavy industry in its land use code. He sees that as a way of better controlling the redevelopment of the dozen or so former industrial sites within the coastal zone along the Delaware River. Similarly, Durham notes that the county sets aside money each year for open space, but doesn't always use it. She'd like to see land use officials meet with organizations like Delaware Wildlands and the Nature Conservancy to help set better priorities for how to acquire open space and to work more closely with these groups, which have considerable resources behind them to actually purchase and acquire more lands and preserve them in that fashion.
And kind of building on that, there is farmland preservation. You talked about that a little bit earlier, particularly in connection to Dave Carter. It's also been a flashpoint recently in Newcastle County. Where do these two stand on what should be done in terms of farmland preservation?
Again, I think you'll see a lot of agreement between the two of them. More of an issue for Carter, again, because it's the southern part of the county that he represents, and that's where much of the county's remaining farmland is. Carter is already pushing to reorganize the county's Farmland Preservation Board, and he wants to see it better aligned with the state's agricultural preservation program. As you indicated, in the past, the county's appraisal process has given farmers more lucrative offers than they would have received under the state's program in exchange for protecting the land or preserving their land from development. Carter would like to see the county and the state work more in tandem so you can prevent this sort of bidding wars and to ensure the best use of the county's fund. And, you know, it's worth noting, you know, he sometimes wonder whether some farmers might encourage developers to suggest subdivision plans on their lands as a way of tempting the government into making larger preservation payments for lands that the farmers may or may not really be interested in selling off for development. But, they wouldn't mind getting the money that's offered by the county, by the state, as an incentive not to develop the property.
Durham's district, the second, as you noted earlier, includes most of the 202 corridor. How to handle that, specifically in the northern end where the new Wilmington University campus is and some other projects may or may not be taking shape is being discussed. Where does she stand on what's next for the Route 202 corridor?
It's important to note that in many cases along Concord Pike, the properties there are already zoned for retail or business use. So you can't stop the redevelopment, but you can look at these subdivision redevelopment plans that have been filed and do your best to ensure that whatever does go up on these sites is really in the best interest of the community. Now, Durham, like Carter, recognizes a need for more moderate income housing in the county, and she's concerned that the apartment units that are being built or proposed along the Concord Pike corridor, at Concord Plaza already by Bacini-Poland Group, at the old AstraZeneca site by the Deladon organization, the Capanos project at the former Brandywine Country Club. So she's concerned that if apartments are built there, that they're not going to meet the needs of this moderate income demographic. And she questions whether the people who are going to live in these units are actually going to work there. I mean, all these developers are talking about this live, work, play sort of environment. But you know, it's in Newcastle County anyway. It's a fairly untested concept. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that either Durham or Carter is a big advocate of low-income housing. I mean, they're not saying that. But they do have a concern for the overall viability of these projects. You know, and what happens if the developers overbuild? They put in more apartments than they can actually lease. Can't fill the rental units. That's got some long-term implications. Another factor looking even farther down the road that concerns Durham, Concord Mall is not Christiana Mall. Let's just put it that way. And you've got that Sears, the last Sears store in Delaware is there, and we know what's happening with Sears. Durham believes that a couple of years down the road, you know, Concord Mall may very well be on its way to being converted into some sort of a multi-use project as well. And who knows what's going to happen there. So it's, you know, one more thing to keep an eye on, and another uncertainty in the Concord Pike corridor.
Another issue at both the state and county level is property reassessment and its impact on school funding. Where do these two come down on this hot button issue of reassessment?
Well, I mean, for years, reassessment has been the third rail of Delaware politics. You know, regardless of party affiliation, no elected official wants to touch it. You know, and with the ACLU's suit against the state and all three counties over inequities in school funding, no one should be surprised if the state and county government's hands are forced sooner rather than later. Now, we understand, of course, that, you know, this week the folks in the General Assembly are saying, no, we're not going to touch this, certainly not right now. Durham favors reassessment as a matter of fairness. She says that it's long overdue. Carter is taking an even stronger position on the issue. He believes that improving public education, including how it's funding infrastructure is set up, is the state's number one economic development issue. And that's a pretty strong statement right there. And for this reason, Carter says he's going to fight for reassessment, and he will advocate for it in county council. And he said if it costs him the chance to win a second term on council, so be it. Reassessment is, and improving the education system as an economic development matter, is that important to him.
Fascinating. So having heard all this, do we expect Carter and Durham to make an immediate impact on council, or may it take some time, perhaps maybe even another election cycle, before we can assess if their presence equals a significant change?
First of all, both Dave Carter and Dee Durham have strong backgrounds, and they've had successful careers. They're not the kind of people who are going to sit in the back of the room and let the old guard continue to do things the way things have always been done. Now, as for them having a significant change, that's a little bit harder to tell. I mean, right now, the council has 12 Democrats and one Republican. Before Durham knocked off Bob Weiner, the split had been 11-2. So, I mean, it's not like the control of the body has been flipped. And so there's going to be a tendency probably among the folks who've been on the council for a long time to say, well, yeah, we've always done it this way. It didn't work before, so why should we try it now? That sort of thing. You know, Carter and Durham are not going to accept that as a good answer, but it still remains to see how much influence they're going to have in terms of actually being able to generate and become real forces for change on the council and how it operates.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on Dave Carter and Dee Durham joining Newcastle County Council is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next, we'll hear from the new head of eBright Health, the partnership between First Aid Hospitals to work on access to health care as well as quality and affordability. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. eBright is a partnership between five of Delaware's hospitals. It got its start in 2016 with a mission to share best practices between the health systems to improve the coordination of patient care, drive down costs, and create better health outcomes for populations with the most need. A month ago, the group tapped Christiana Care Health System's Corporate Director of Benefits and Wellness, Chris Corbo, to take on the role of Executive Director. Corbo recently spoke with Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino to discuss eBright's strategy for addressing the opioid crisis and the rising cost of health care in the state of Delaware.
eBright Health is an alliance of five healthcare systems in Delaware. It was founded in 2016, and it's a statewide strategic alliance to increase access to health care, improve quality and affordability of care, and offer all Delawareans an even brighter healthcare future. And we're going to do that through collaborating and innovation and learning from one another. The five systems include Bay Health, BB Healthcare, Christiana Care Health System, Nanticoke Health Services, and Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children.
All right, and can you tell me a bit about yourself, what led you to be appointed to this new role as Executive Director of eBright?
Sure. For the last 13 years, I was Corporate Director of Benefits and Wellness at Christiana Care Health System. So I was on the other side of healthcare, you know, trying to improve the health for our employees and dependents, make access very affordable so that they can have great healthcare, and to lower the costs, not only for the employees and dependents, but make it affordable for the healthcare system. So as part of my role, I was involved in wellness programs to improve the health of the organization and of its employees, also in population health initiatives in terms of coordinating the care. Those that may have a condition, maybe 5% of the population that might drive 60 or 70% of the cost, making sure that they have the proper care, that their care is coordinated, and that they have different professionals like pharmacists and social workers and healthcare providers to work with them in their care. So that's sort of how I became involved in that with eBright Health, is, you know, improving the health and reducing costs for the healthcare system.
And that is an issue on the forefront of the medical stories here in Delaware. The governor did issue an executive order putting into place a healthcare spending benchmark based off of recommendations from Dr. Walker, the Secretary of Health and Social Services. What is your take on the policy of the benchmark going forward?
I'm not an expert in the benchmark, but I can tell you what eBright Health is doing to reduce costs, improve health outcomes. Part of it is, you know, shared learnings, standardizing processes, using our scale to reduce costs in our supply chain, and some of the services that we purchase. using population health to coordinate care for those that may be sick. So those are the main things, is really standardizing process, and if we can prevent illnesses and really focus on wellness and keeping our community healthy, we can reduce costs.
And that is a theme you hear when you talk to different people in the medical profession about value-based care, is the coordination of care in certain populations, as you mentioned earlier, to bring up the health and avoid trips to the emergency department. One hospital in the eBright system, Nanticoke, recently moved all of its health contracts towards value-based care. Do you see that as a theme going forward for some of the other hospitals in eBright to bring down the cost?
Well, you know, I can't comment on, you know, each healthcare system, but I can tell you in general, healthcare is going to go away from fee for service, and it's going to be outcome-driven, community-driven, in terms of, you know, here's a population you need to manage, and you're going to get paid from that aspect. So one of the initiatives from eBright Health is, how do we prepare when we go from fee from service to different types of payment arrangements from other payers? And that's part of learning from each other, standardizing processes, and preparing for the future. I think it sort of takes a village, you know, having five of us together, working together instead of acting independently as individuals, can help us with achieving all of our goals, which is to improve health outcomes, reduce costs, and you know, make it easier for the average person to navigate the healthcare marketplace.
One of the other foremost challenges here in the First State is, of course, the opioid crisis. DHSS is predicting that last year more than 400 people died in the state of Delaware as a result of drug overdose. It has risen each year for, I believe, the past 6 years in the state. And as new policies are rolling out, looking to deal with these challenges, while they are still new policies and we haven't really gotten to see how they work, it has thus far been ineffective. What is your take on the overdose system of care, as well as the START program, which has been put into place in all of the hospitals you represent?
So first of all, this is one of the great crises, not only in the state of Delaware, but across the United States. As you mentioned, there were over 400 deaths in the state of Delaware, and it's rising rapidly. So eBright Health actually has a committee, representation from all of the five healthcare institutions to work on this issue, and it's involving with prescribing the right products, making sure that there is more education with instructions, and that the appropriate duration is being prescribed, and that, as well as looking for opportunities to look for alternatives to treat pain. So again, this is a huge issue. We're really focused on it. I can share with you that eBright Health has all partnered together to apply for a major grant that would bring large funding into the state of Delaware, really targeting members that are in the criminal justice system or already in jail or in the ERs, targeting those individuals and trying to get them with coordinated care. So again, it's a huge issue. We're really focused on it, and we have groups tackling this right now.
And that is certainly something that has been successful in other states. I know Rhode Island was able to bring down the rate of overdoses in their state by allowing medication-assisted treatment in the prison system. But what about the people who are out in the streets overdosing and ending up in emergency rooms? I know the state, as part of its SMART program, has put in peer mentors into the different emergency rooms in hospitals across the state. Are you at eBright seeing success in the emergency rooms in there as they get started putting in these care coordinators and peer mentors?
You know, I think it's a slow process, and you know, I think we're looking for different ways to, you know, have interventions in the emergency rooms. And, you know, again, these are the issues that we are going to tackle from a, you know, from an eBright Health organization. The grant that I was talking about would have even more resources to have interventions in the emergency rooms and to get those folks with coordinated care and more of a population health model with treating, you know, the addiction and the overdose.
Chris Corbo, Executive Director of eBright, is there anything else you'd like to add about some of the innovations and partnerships that might lead to anything new here in the state from your collaboration of hospitals?
Well, I just think it's an exciting time in healthcare where, you know, we can bring the five organizations in the state of Delaware, and it's a little bit unique in Delaware. We're such a small state, so these efforts can really address the whole statewide issue of healthcare. And I think with bringing together everyone to share best practices, share knowledges, and use our scale, getting the cost out of the system ultimately can improve healthcare outcomes, but also reduce healthcare costs or the rise of the rate that it has been in the past.
Thanks to new eBright Executive Director Chris Corbo and our Nick Schellino for their time on The Green this week. Arts Playlist is next, where we catch up with the artist behind the iconic Fearless Girl sculpture on Wall Street. Stick around for that here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The most well-known piece from a Lewis sculptor has a new home at the New York Stock Exchange. We're talking about Fearless Girl, the brainchild of Kristen Visbau. Fearless Girl was first installed near Wall Street in March 2017 in honor of International Women's Day. The bronze sculpture depicts a young girl standing fearlessly with her hands on her hips. It was placed opposite the iconic Charging Bull sculpture on Wall Street. Recently, Fearless Girl was moved, in part due to the traffic hazard caused by crowds around her and Charging Bull. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele speaks with Visbau about the move and her work.
All right, let's talk about Fearless Girl. Initially, Fearless Girl was installed on Wall Street, and you got a lot of flack for it to begin with, yes?
It was a mixed review. I think, politically speaking, some people were kind of taken aback by Fearless Girl, but she was placed there in celebration of women and in celebration of International Women's Day 2017. So originally she was placed at the Bowling Green Park on Wall Street, which is a triangular park. And what we did is we extended that point in order to install Fearless Girl on city property in a statement against the All Boys Club of Wall Street, which the Charging Bull had come to symbolize. And as a statement again about the future of women in business and their importance.
So how long was it at that location?
Well, we just moved her. So she was unveiled last Monday at the New York City Stock Exchange and actually removed the week before. So that's almost 2 years, about a year and 8 months, I guess.
Okay. All right. What prompted the move, Kristen?
Well, the primary, let me preface this by saying I created the work. The concept of placing a child in front of the bull is the brainchild of McCann, New York. We had a committee of 30 people, and maybe six of those, including myself, were really involved in the creative aspect of what Fearless Girl would look like, what kind of hairstyle she would have, et cetera. So State Street sponsored our project. They actually own the casting on Wall Street and have been working diligently with the New York City mayor's office regarding her status and her future. So the mayor's office has the final say on where Fearless Girl goes, and the decision was made to remove her from Bowling Green Park for two reasons. One, that park needs a renovation. And the most important issue was because Fearless Girl is on that very narrow point at the end of the park, anybody who's coming and posing with her and getting their photo taken is actually in harm's way because of all the traffic on both sides of the park. So really, the move has to do with safety. It also is an appropriate move because Fearless Girl, although her message is very broad, her roots are in the financial arena. So moving her to the New York City Stock Exchange, which is now being run by a woman, is very appropriate.
All right. Is this a permanent, is this the permanent home for Fearless Girl?
Well, you know, again, that final, you know, the final say would be the mayor's office. But as I understand it, A, she has achieved a status of permanence, which is rare, if ever, granted to a sculpture. So we're very excited about that. And I do think she will be staying at the New York City Stock Exchange for a very long time.
How long have you been sculpting?
Well, let's see. It's been about 23 years. I went back to college at Salisbury State in Maryland, and I was a graphic design major, and I took an elective course in clay modeling and dug my hands in clay and changed my major to sculpture. I then, you know, once I finished my BA in art, I went to study lost wax casting at the Johnson Atelier, which is a French word for studio. So the Johnson Atelier Foundry, which is affiliated with the current Grand Tour Sculpture Park in Mercerville, New Jersey. So the foundry's closed, but they were open for 32 years, and it was this wonderful, wonderful place where apprentices from all over the world could come and work every aspect of the lost wax casting process. So typically, if you want to learn the process, you go to a foundry, you're going to be pigeonholed in one aspect of production or the other because it takes a certain amount of time to achieve a skill level at each aspect. But at this place, they have 60 employees and roughly 20 apprentices, and we could move through the entire process. I had internships in mold making and patina and wax chasing.
Great. This is all great. Yeah. Would you call Kristen Fearless Girl your most major accomplishment in your years of sculpting, or one of the most major?
Well, I think that she's the one that's the famous work that's most well known, that has an impact on society, because she really takes the feminist movement idea of equality and gives it a visual. So because of that, she had a great impact. I have many public works, Alexander Hamilton. I have several nautical pieces in Florida that are really very big and much more detailed than Fearless Girl. I did 10 Hall of Fame football coaches, Ara Parseghian, Paul Brown, who's considered the father of football. That Cradle Coaches collection of 10 larger-than-life works is in Ohio. So I guess it depends on your perspective as to what is most important. But I think Fearless Girl is the one that's packed the real punch because she affects all of us.
That's
so
great.
It's a societal work that's really sending an underlying message of collaboration between men and women. So it's not so much, about women getting their just dues or women supporting other women. It's about all of this research that surrounds Fearless Girl that says, hey, you know, men and women it's been proven by all these studies, are actually much more effective working together. We're a natural and perfect complement to one another. We solve problems differently. Our brains function differently. You know, men use more gray matter, making them really good at seizing on an opportunity and hyper-focusing. Women use more white brain matter, which makes them, yes, more emotional, but really good at multitasking. They have found that companies that incorporate women have a better work environment, are less litigious, and the final decision that we make when we're working together as genders is much, much more effective and more profitable than those being made by one group of gender versus the other.
Thanks to Lewis sculptor Kristen Visbau and our Kelly Steele for their time in this week's Arts Playlist. The Green concludes in a moment with Enlighten Me and a look at what was lost late last month when a historic Lenape church in Cheswold burned to the ground. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. When the Little Union Church in Cheswold, Delaware burned down at the end of last month, a piece of history disappeared. The church was a historically Lenape church. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt sits down with Chief of the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, Dennis Coker, and Richard Durham of an associated church to talk about Little Union and its roots in the Lenape community.
What was known as the Little Union Church on West Denny's Road was not owned by the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, but it had deep ties to the Lenape or Delaware Moore community in Cheswold. I'm here to talk about it with Principal Chief of the Tribe, Dennis Coker, and Richard Durham, who's a member of the Board of Trustees of the Emmanuel Union United Methodist Church in Cheswold. Chief Dennis Coker, I was wondering if you could give me a sense for what your first reaction was when you heard about the fire.
Certainly, Sophia. It was a devastating event. The church building itself, even though it was not owned by our tribe or the Emmanuel Union Church currently, was the anchor for the cultural mapping project that we were initiating for the Fort Branch area. So losing that anchor, it seems that we're a little bit adrift right now, and we really haven't come to grips with the repercussions of that fire, so we're kind of working through those details right now.
And Mr. Durham, you have family that's actually buried in the cemetery that's right next to the Little Union Church, correct?
That is correct. I have family that, of course, is buried at the Fort Branch Cemetery across the street, which the Little Union Church owned at the time, and the cemetery that is all the way around on all three sides of the church. I believe it's my grandfather that's buried behind the church, Benjamin Durham, and he would have been one of the owners of the Benjamin Durham house up mm-hmm. on the hill mm-hmm. that we had that got destroyed.
According to one, and there are, I actually found two somewhat conflicting historical records here, but according to one historic catalog that's in the Delaware Public Archives, the Little Union Church was organized first in 1850, but it said that the most recent structure was built in 1883. I'll start with you, Mr. Durham. What can you tell me about the history of the church?
Well, seeing as how I'm still quite young, the history that I have been has been handed down to us basically would be the same history that the Little Union Church started off as a little slab shanty. The pastor of Little Union Church was also the pastor of the former Manship Church in Cheswold. The congregation kept meeting at Little Union. I have same family members that was going to Little Union, going to Manship in Cheswold. Just different brothers might have gone, you know, different places. But still family members that were still located together. And it wasn't until about 1947 that Little Union felt that they couldn't keep their doors open. They did not have enough members still coming that they could keep their doors open. And that's when the decision was made to join with Manship in Cheswold. And Manship and Little Union merged together by 1948, and they changed the name of the church to Emmanuel Union. We picked up the Emmanuel for God with us, and the Union came from the Little Union. So we became one church by 1948.
So, Chief Coker, can you tell me a little bit about the church's connection to the Lenape community in Cheswold?
Certainly. The Fork Branch area was somewhat of a subset of the Cheswold community. And it's not really clear to me where the line was drawn that would have indicated which part of the community that you participated in. So, at Fork Branch, there was a school, there was a church, there's a cemetery. And in Cheswold proper, in town, there was a school, there's a church, and there's a cemetery. So the roots are very deep in Fork Branch for our community, and I would venture to say that maybe the oldest internment there may be older than the ones at Emmanuel Union. I'm not absolutely sure. We've always celebrated the existence of Fork Branch just simply because many of our citizens were schooled at the Fork Branch School.
That school building also no longer stands there.
No.
So, you know, Little Union Church is not the first historic landmark that has been lost at the Fork Branch area. So
no, absolutely. We had our school really in Cheswold, which was a two-room schoolhouse that was demolished in the mid-60s, 1960s. And at that same time, we lost the Fort Branch School building, which was a one-room schoolhouse. It actually suffered a fire as well. And so the only two structures that we had remaining, which were community structures, were the two churches. And now the loss of the Fork Branch Church building leaves one remaining structure that can, you know, definitively be tied to the Cheswold Lenape community. So it is diminishing, and it's very sad.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean to a community like yours to lose a historic landmark like this one?
Well, it's certainly every community, I think, is rooted in its cohesiveness. And so when we start to lose these structures, that cohesiveness seems to degrade a little bit. I remember my relationship with the Fort Branch School. We used to meet with our Cub Scout Pack 283. In the Fort Branch School. So that would have been more probably around the early part of the 60s, a year or two maybe before they actually closed the school building. So these properties that we look at and we try to honor because they were the home and the activity centers of the ancestors of our community, are very important to us. And when we lose them, it's like, you know, having a part of your heart kind of ripped out because, you know, we're an underserved community. We're really not able to fundraise to a great extent to make these repairs and to reacquire these properties. So we're constantly looking for assistance through some funding mechanism, whether it be grants or endowments or someone that sympathizes with our plight and our cause, and that could be challenging at times.
So, Chief Coker, you and I spoke once in the past kind of about your hopes for the Fork mm-hmm. Branch area. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the remediation of mm-hmm. The school property. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned sort of a hope of having like a community center one yeah. day on that land. I'm wondering if and I'll also mention that area. Another reason it's important is the only land that the tribe owns, that roughly half yes. acre, is right next to the church property.
Yeah, absolutely. We had approached the administrative services of the state back in the latter part of the 1990s, maybe the early part of 2000s, when we learned that the small arms training facility was going to be abandoned when they had started planning for a new facility. We thought that we would get that property returned to our community. And so we stayed in touch with our legislators and finally made some headway with them to commit to returning the property. But the obstacle was that it had a lead contamination from having been used as a firearms training facility for nearly 40 years. So we're in the middle of the environmental assessments. Hopefully within another year, that property will be given a clean bill of health. And when it does, it's our goal to have it returned to the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware. And our plans were to try to reacquire the church and then move it across the road to the school property because the church in its current location was threatened. The very face of the church was on the Del Dot right-of-way. We thought that we would make an attempt to move the structure across the street if we could reacquire it and then have it become the basis for a community center, somewhat of a museum and a meeting place, and then maybe build a small addition to it for an administrative office area so that we could begin to own our community center as opposed to renting it. So that area, since we own a piece of property there, the tribe does. The church and its cemeteries are there. The school property is there. It begins to take shape as a land base that we would own and control in our community, which is very important for us when we talk about sovereignty and independent existence. We can start to take the steps to display what that really means to us as a Native American community.
Dickie Durham and Principal Chief of the uh-huh. Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, Dennis Coker, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The fire at Little Union is still under investigation by the state fire marshal and federal agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The state fire marshal says that the current owner of the building is Fellowship Pentecostal Church. They could not be reached for comment.
Thanks to Chief of the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, Dennis Coker, Richard Durham of the Emmanuel Union United Methodist Church, and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagyest, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.